And this, of course, is the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein.
It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. Oh, in the name of God. Now I know what it feels like to be God.
Ah, yes. Remember that old movie where Dr. Frankenstein created Frankenstein? Mary Shelley wrote the book about 200 years ago this year. In a moment, Les Klinger joins us on Coast to Coast. His new work is called The New Annotated Frankenstein, and he's next. And welcome back to Coast. Les Klinger back with us, considered to be one of the world's foremost authorities on those twin icons of the Victorian era, Sherlock Holmes and Dracula. Now, since the 1960s, the study of the rich, fantastic literature of the Victorian writers has been Klinger's consuming passion. In addition, he is a longtime supporter of Loyola University Chicago's Life After Innocence and was thrilled to be asked by Laura Caldwell to co-edit The Anatomy of Innocence and to have an opportunity to work with some incredible individuals whose stories are told in that book. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Les, always a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks, George. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
200 years ago, Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein.
It's astonishing to think about that because it seems to have been with us forever, and that proves it. Plus, when we think about the fact of how old she was when she wrote it, as we'll talk about, it's really an astonishing record.
What possessed her to write that book?
Well, the story of how it was created has become almost legend. In fact, there was a film made about it by Kurt Russell, Ken Russell. The story goes that she and her then-boyfriend, Percy Shelley, had traveled to Italy specifically to go see Lord Byron. And while they were there, Byron, by the way, at the time, was sort of the most famous person in the world. He had left England because it was getting a little hot for him with his sort of sexual escapades.
Uh-huh.
But they traveled to Italy. They spent the summer living near him. And Byron proposed a contest. He said that we should all sit down and write a ghost story. Well, Percy Shelley pretty much failed at it. Byron wrote a small fragment. His companion, John Polidori, wrote a wonderful piece called The Vampire, which became the first English-language vampire novel. And Mary came up with this idea for a story about a student who late at night is busy reanimating a corpse. That became chapter 4, eventually, of the novel Frankenstein. But so this is 1816. She began working on it.
Amazing. She was about 21 years old when she published it, wasn't she?
Correct. Yeah, she was only 19 when she conceived the idea.
Jeez.
For it. So these were wild children. Percy, the famous English poet, was only 24, Byron wasn't much older. He was just a few years older than them. These were clearly very young people by our modern standards, and yet. She was remarkably mature. She was expected to be a prodigy. Her parents were William Godwin, the leading intellectual of England, and Mary Wollstonecraft, who had written a magnificent book called The Vindication of the Rights of Women. There were high expectations pinned to her.
She died in 1851, way before she was going to make any money from... the books in subsequently, I bet she never even knew it would be turned into a movie.
Well, that's right. Although she may have had some inkling of it, because almost immediately after publication, it became a successful stage play. Now, she didn't make any money off of it. It was ripped off by, there was just the typical situation there, that as soon as the novel was published, playwrights would seize upon it and write plays. So it was a big hit on the stage, and it stayed a big hit pretty much throughout her lifetime, but she didn't get any royalties from that.
Yeah, well, they probably altered it a little bit and just did their own little thing.
Original title was Presumption.
Now, the little movie clip that I just played, of course, the original black and white, sometimes they always say the book is better than the movie. What do you think?
Well, the 1931 film is a brilliant film, but it has very little to do with the book. many, many people have seen the movie and think they know the story of Frankenstein. The movie is really a story about a scientist who is probably on the verge of sanity, and who is, and the moral of the movie is clearly be careful with your science, because there are some things that are too dangerous to mess with. That is not at all the theme of the book. The book is about parenting, really, in a sense. I mean, I've said to somebody the other day, we all are like Dr. Frankenstein in the sense that we give, if those of us who are parents, you know, we give birth to children, and it's our responsibility to see that they don't turn into monsters. So what the book is about Victor Frankenstein abandoning the responsibility of raising his progeny.
The book itself that she wrote was part of a ghost story, right?
Well, it started that way. It started with this sort of ghostly vision of the revivification of the creature. But it went far beyond that, ultimately. It has many autobiographical elements in it. She created a frame story. The whole story is really wrapped around a narrative by a man named Robert Walton, who's a young man exploring the Arctic. And he meets Victor Frankenstein, who is chasing the creature at that point. And Victor tells him his story.
And what was that story?
Well, the story is about how, as a young man and as a student, he's fascinated by the concept of creating life. He wants to know, he wants to understand, as did the scientists of the day, he wanted to understand what made something alive. This was a topic that was very much in the air at the time that Mary Shelley wrote the book. Electricity was a pretty new discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists were convinced that electricity had a great deal to do with life. Luigi Galvani actually tried to reanimate corpses of criminals by using electricity. So this wasn't her idea. Now, she doesn't explicitly say in the book that Victor was using electricity, by the way, but that's where the movies went. But that was, in fact, a study that was going on. And there was a lot of discussion in the scientific press about what was life, what made life, what was, you know, was there a soul, was there something tangible that could be measured. So Victor has decided he wants to figure out what is the difference between death and life, and he eventually discovers the secret. He doesn't tell us what it is, but he discovers the secret. He creates this creature. He makes the creature out of body parts that he finds in morgues and charnel houses and all that. There's not a criminal brain. That's made up for the movies. But this creature is 7 feet tall, yellow skin, ugly as get out, and nonetheless comes to life. Now, this is a blank slate. The creature is not evil. The creature knows nothing. But Victor is so appalled at what he did, that he immediately passes out, and the creature, confused, sort of runs out into the night. And Victor falls into a swoon. He's sick for a month. He's in a coma, and he never takes up looking for the creature. He never really tries to take care of the creature. So the creature has to make do on
its own. Yeah.
Yes. And so a great deal of the book is about the experiences of the creature, and they're really harsh treatment the creature receives at the hands of people who find the creature so repulsive that they don't want to give him the time of day. They don't give him a chance to be a good person because they're forever chasing him or whatever. This is not the creature of the movies. This is not some idiot monster walking around attacking people. And in fact, the creature makes a home for himself observing a family, the De Lacys. And by observing them, he learns to speak, and he eventually learns to read, and he becomes quite educated, quite sophisticated, only to find himself again rejected by the family when he tries to present himself to them.
Because he's still so hideous looking?
Yes. He frightens them considerably, and they chase him away again. And so he just keeps getting buffered, you know, from place to place as he's rejected over and over again. Finally, he does become outraged, and he decides to take revenge on Victor. He figures out that Victor was his creator. He finds notes in the pocket of the jacket he's wearing, and he tries to track down Victor. On his way back to Geneva, where Victor lives, this takes place in Ingolstadt around the university originally. On his way back there, he meets in the woods Victor's youngest brother, who again abuses him, and in a fit of rage, the creature murders this little boy. And this finally sort of sets him on the path of vengeance now. And it escalates. He eventually has a confrontation with Victor. He threatens Victor, "I will be with you on your wedding night." Victor interprets this as a threat to his bride-to-be, mm-hmm. not understanding that it's a threat. He interprets it as a threat to himself, not understanding it's a threat to his bride-to-be, Elizabeth. Eventually, the creature murders Elizabeth as well. And then Victor really goes sort of off the rails and hunts the creature for the rest of the book.
So the creature really goes batty after a while.
Yes, he's highly articulate. He compares himself to Satan as being sort of cast out. There's a great deal of the Milton Prometheus bound material there. There's the Ancient Mariner is mixed into the story and so on. There's a lot of literary allusions. The creature is highly articulate, intelligent, well-read, and just feels ostracized. At some point, he actually begs Victor to create a mate for him so that he and his mate can go off and live in the desert and never bother humans again. But Victor is appalled by this idea, and although he first does create the female, he destroys the female.
Is that where we get the movie The Bride of Frankenstein?
Yes. Although the movie has nothing, zero, to do with the book. But it's where the idea came from.
It's amazing. Now, what possessed Mary? You know, she was writing it originally. It was a ghost story competition, wasn't it?
Yes. So where did she go with this? Well, part of this was about, I think, her own family. Her father and William Godwin and Percy Shelley, both were great exponents of the romantic ideal, the rugged individual, communing with nature, and all those things. Mary really felt quite differently. Mary felt that family, motherhood, those were very important things, I think in part because she didn't have them herself. Her mother died within 10 days of her birth, of Mary's birth. Her father raised her, and her father was a little distant, let's say. She worshipped her father, but her father's idea of education was, there's some really good books over there, Mary. You should read them. And that's pretty much the way she grew up. So I think this book, a lot of it expresses her feelings about her own upbringing and her own father and eventually her husband, and that she didn't like that.
Well, can you blame her?
No. But again, you know, she's 19 years old when she starts writing this. She's writing what she knows. She's writing her own personal experiences.
There was some controversy that maybe the boyfriend turned to the husband, Percy, wrote the book.
Yes, indeed. Percy, of course, by this time was already a renowned poet, and the book was, as was common, was published anonymously. And so in the beginning, the critics quickly concluded, because it was dedicated to William Godwin, Mary's father, and Percy was a well-known disciple of Godwin, they concluded that Percy himself had written it. The only critic who came to a different conclusion was Sir Walter Scott, who thought it was Mary because he knew her and he knew her talents. The answer is, in fact, that it probably should be a shared credit. Not that I want to diminish in any way Mary's vital importance to the book, but if you look at the original manuscript, and in my book I actually reproduced a couple of pages of it, it's at the Bodleian Library in Oxford, you'll see that there are sections where Percy has written in words, he's edited it. This wasn't because Mary was weak, it was because they had a wonderful intellectual partnership. They had already collaborated on a previous book called A 6 Weeks Journey, and she clearly read and collaborated on some of his poetry. Theirs was a strong collaborative marriage. So did he have ideas? Did he change some of the language here and there? Yes, he did. Now, we should talk at some point, George, about the 1831 edition, which has its own fans.
Right. She upgraded it. How come?
Well, so by 1831, so Percy is 5 years older than her. Tragically, in 1822, he dies, and she is left alone. By that point in time, she's born four children, only one of whom has survived. So in 1822, 1823, she's starting to get some ideas that are very different from what she had before. Her father has put out a new edition of the book in 1825, and Mary decides that perhaps it's time to revise the book. So she actually revises it quite substantially. The revised edition comes out in 1831. And in some ways, Victor Frankenstein is a kinder, gentler person. He is much more a victim of fate. He's not as evil.
The movie had him depicted as a whack job scientist, didn't he?
Right. But, I mean, Mary herself had changed. Mary was feeling depressed, beat upon by destiny, and was willing, I think, to give Victor a little more forgiveness than she was when she wrote this passionate indictment in 1818.
I want to talk when we come back after the break about The Watchmen, the annotated edition, about that book that came out in 1986, but back to Frankenstein for a little bit.
Great.
How did the book, does the book and the movie end the same way with, you know, fire and brimstone?
Not at all. In fact, it's really a, if I may say so, a polar opposite. The book ends with the creature disappearing into the ice of the Arctic ice caps. And in fact, in the original edition, it's, if you read the words, it just says he disappears into the darkness. Victor is dead. Victor has died of a brain fever or something. But the creature goes off into the night, presumably dead, but we don't know.
It's amazing work. Are there ever people like that anymore who can write like that?
Oh, I think there's some great writers since Mary Shelley, but this was so, you know, she was such a prodigy, first of all. I don't know any 19-year-olds who can write like that.
No.
The book was very powerful, but it inspired some great books. I mean, there's certainly been other great works of, what shall we call them, science fiction, horror, etc., Dracula being one. H.G. Wells's powerful writing and so on, that some of them inspired by Frankenstein. Certainly the writers were knowledgeable of Frankenstein. And it's a classic for a reason, but I think there are other great books out there too.
Well, I got to tell you, 200 years and it's still going strong. A lot of people remember the movie, the book, and everything else.
That's true. That's true. We should all be so lucky to have books that are still read 200 years later.
That's absolutely right. Les, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll talk about some more of your other works. But that is hard to believe. 200 years ago, a person by the name of Mary Shelley wrote the book and the novel on Frankenstein. If you need to email me, george@coasttocoastam.com. Don't forget to like us at Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, where we send out little quick messages all the time about the program and things you should watch out for. Les Klinger, our special guest in the last hour of the program, of course, will take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. With Les Klinger joining us, fascinating stuff. The Frankenstein stuff was amazing. He's also written books about Dracula and everything else, so we'll get into most of those when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Les Klinger with us. Les, the Watchmen series, of course, which was created by Alan Moore, the artist was David Gibbons. They were a great team. I never got into that novel at all, but tell me about your work with that.
Well, it's been called the greatest graphic novel ever written. And after I finished doing the annotated Sandman was another 78-issue long story by my friend Neil Gaiman, brilliant literary mythological comic story. I was out having lunch at DC. I said to them, gosh, my dream project would be to do an annotated edition of Watchmen. They said, make us a proposal. And I thought it was really worth doing it. In part, and this is the frightening part, George, you know, 86, 87, when those were coming out, is now more than 30 years ago. And there are people who don't remember who Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford,
right.
Those people were. They vaguely heard of the Vietnam War. And all of that is very much the story of Watchmen. And so I thought it needed to be represented with a lot of historical and cultural material in notes, and it was a thrill to do. I also, Dave Gibbons fortunately had copies of all of Alan Moore's amazing scripts. Alan would produce a script, so the issues were 22 pages long. He would typically produce a 100-page script for each issue. So I got to read those and use material from those in the book as well.
What was the plot generally for that?
Well, it starts out as a mystery. It's an alternate universe in which costumed adventurers, Batman-like creatures, have become sort of mainstream. They're vigilantes and then outlawed. And then accidentally there is a genuine superhero, sort of a Superman kind of individual created by a science experiment. His name is Dr. Manhattan. And Moore wanted to explore how the existence of an almost godlike being in the world would change the way our culture develops. And so it's an alternate universe exploring a different timeline. Richard Nixon has 4 terms as president.
It's like like an alternate universe,
yeah.
Isn't it?
We win the Vietnam War because Dr. Manhattan fights on our side, and basically the Viet Cong give up, and history is completely altered. But the core of the story is that we are once again on the brink of nuclear disaster. The Russians and Nixon are, you know, shaking their sabers, and I don't want to give too much away, but it involves a master criminal's idea of how to save the world. So it's a brilliant story. It's a very frightening story. It's interesting. When I wrote the preface to it, the introduction to it, back in January of 2017, I said, isn't it great that we're not living under the cloud of nuclear apocalypse? That was a mere 12 months ago.
Yeah, exactly. Look what's happened now.
Yeah.
Interesting take on all of that, the Watchmen series. And is it still out for people?
Absolutely. It just came out. The book just came out in December. It's this big, it's not something that guys can read in the bathroom. It's an enormous sort of 14 by 14 book with the full pages of the comics with large columns with notes in them. Widely available. The only bad news is that we couldn't reproduce the brilliant color work of John Higgins because that would have made the book cost $150 instead of what it cost. So it's black and white, but the advantage of the black and white is you can really see the details. Gibbons is a fabulous artist. And by the way, he was very involved in the project. He read every single note, gave me extensive feedback about what I'd gotten right, things that I maybe had not quite understood properly, and so on. So it was a fascinating project to do. It's very different writing an annotated book with a live creator. You know, I didn't get to ask Mary Shelley questions about why she did things she did.
Did you ever talk to Alan Moore? He's still alive.
So Alan, he is still alive, and he actually wrote the introduction for my Lovecraft book, which I talked about in the show a couple years ago.
That's right.
And he wants nothing to do with Watchmen anymore. He has a long-running, I guess I'd call it feud, with DC. He's very unhappy with the way that they've basically kept the book in print and done so many sort of spin-offs from it.
He didn't make any money on it or something.
Oh, I don't think that's the problem. I think he's made plenty of money off of it, but he never got creative input on it. And he's a genuine artist. He's a genius, and he's just very unhappy with what happened. And so he said to me, look, I'm not going to say don't do the project, but it's a closed chapter of my life. I just don't want to participate. Gibbons didn't feel that way, fortunately.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about some of your other works, but because we're talking about monsters, the new annotated Dracula that you wrote about that.
Yes. Well, that's such a delicious project. I love Dracula, but it takes us back to a simpler time, George. The hard part for the reader of Dracula today, I find the book incredibly scary. I remember reading it in college and being just scared witless by the story. But that was before the glut of vampire movies, TV shows, and all that. If you read the book today, you have to restrain yourself from yelling at the characters halfway through it, "You dummies, it's a vampire!"
Run!
They didn't know. You know, the public didn't.
And then, they glamorized the vampires. Bram Stoker's, he was an ugly troll, practically.
Exactly. He's an old man with long fingernails, hair growing on his palms, and all that. But it's a very powerful book, and it's really about, in many ways, it's a metaphor for sort of foreigners invading and taking our women. But it's a very scary book, and it's a delicious read. Once again, like Frankenstein, very different from the film. If you've only seen the film, you're in for a real treat by reading that.
Is that Nosferatu, that one?
Well, I was thinking of the 1931 Bela Lugosi film, but Nosferatu. Okay. Nosferatu, actually, glad you mentioned that, is much closer to the original.
That's what I thought.
Scary, rat-like, ugly vampire.
Yes.
But now when we get to Lugosi, we have this sort of lounge lizard, you know, with the slick back hair and well-dressed aristocrat.
Yes. Great pronunciations and things like that, and he kind of ropes people in.
I want to drink your... I do not drink wine. Yes, right. All those great lines. So... Children of the night, what lovely music they make.
Are you working on some new crime writing books?
Yes, you know, my original passion, what got me into all this stuff, was, of course, Sherlock Holmes. And people have said I'm the world's greatest Sherlock Holmes expert. I was, like to say, one of the world's greatest Sherlock Holmes expert. And I've had tremendous fun consulting on the films over the years and comic books and books about Holmes and so on. So I love the mystery field. I wanted to get back to it. So the next book I'm working on is actually called A Classic American Crime Writing of the 1920s. It's five novels, heavily annotated. It's the first Charlie Chan mystery, the first Ellery Queen, the first Philo Vance. Philo Vance was far and away the most popular detective of the era, and nobody remembers him. The first Hardy Boys mystery, and the wonderful novel Little Caesar, which became the great Edward G. Robinson film.
And how did you pick the subjects?
Well, as I said, I wanted to get back to mysteries, and I came, after looking at it, I decided to focus on American, because I'm American. And American crime writing really had not much to say for itself between Edgar Allan Poe and the 1920s. Although mysteries were very popular, it was the British mysteries that people were reading. So certainly Sherlock Holmes, but even after Sherlock Holmes, people were reading the British writers of the day. It wasn't until the 1920s, with Biggers' Charlie Chan novel and Philo Vance, that suddenly American mystery writing was the top of the bestseller list. And so I wanted to explore that.
You know, ironically, in the 20s, of course, when you were doing this, back with the series, we had radio just started in the 20s.
Yes.
Television was not here. People really turned to newspapers and books for their information, didn't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there are some films. I mean, there's an early silent film of Charlie Chan from 1925. Philo Vance was one of the first really, really successful talkie series. There was a series of 12 films, originally starring William Powell as Philo Vance, later Basil Rathbone. So the movies, you know, especially during the Depression years, became a very important medium. But right, radio had just begun and no television. So it was books, 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 and then films.
Another one of your works, In the Shadow of Agatha Christie, Forgotten Female Crime Writers.
Yes, that's an interesting series. I don't know if we've talked about that little series before. I have four books with the clever title In the Shadow of. The first one is Sherlock Holmes, the second one is Dracula, the third one is Edgar Allan Poe. These are collections of stories by writers who have, I feel, gotten lost in the shadow of the better known figures. So classic detective stories from Sherlock Holmes' era that people don't read anymore. Classic vampire stories, classic horror stories. And this collection is about forgotten female crime writers on whose shoulders Agatha Christie really stood. Basically writing between 1850 and 1916, they were prolific, they were superb writers, and people don't remember them at all anymore. People like Anna Katharine Green, who had a huge success in a book called The Leavenworth Case, and then went on and wrote a whole bunch of additional novels. Meta Fuller, who wrote probably the first full-length American detective novel called The Dead Letter, and so on. So I felt that these writers deserved to get out of the shadow.
And what the mindset between, at that time, male and female writers, was it unusual for female writers to be crime writers?
It was unusual for female writers to be writing anything that wasn't romance.
Really?
It was still tough for women to sell their stories, and many of them used initials or sort of androgynous names where the publisher maybe didn't know it was a woman, or anonymous. For example, there's an Australian writer, I included one of her stories in the book. Her real name was Mary Fortune. She wrote over 500 stories about an Australian policeman, all published anonymously.
How do you get your money that way?
Well, I think they probably paid her in cash.
Maybe then. Well, with all these crime writers, I mean, did they also look at real crimes too, or just novels?
Sure. In fact, in the beginning, crime writing, when it began to flourish in the 19th century, was originally probably mostly true stories written by people like Eugène Vidocq, who was a criminal turned policeman who founded the French Sûreté. It was his memoirs. And maybe the memoirs got embellished a little bit. Some of the early successful books were things like Memoirs of a Police Officer, Memoirs of a Detective, Secrets of a Private Inquiry Office, and so on. So they were, in many cases, they were true stories, but sometimes they were filled out with sort of additional stories that the writers wrote in the same style because they didn't have enough material. So it was a mixture of what we would now call true crime and made-up stories. And interestingly, I think the foundation of all of this in America was the first crime writing in America was sermons. Preachers who basically found that they could captivate their audiences with tales about criminals, with awful people the criminals
and
were.
And sin, I guess.
Yes,
right?
Criminals who were sinning, ultimately punished, and of course the audience is just thrilled to hear in detail about those sins.
They love those stories.
Yes.
Hey, when you wrote about Edgar Allan Poe, what did you find out about the guy?
Well, he was, of course, much more popular outside America than inside America.
Was he an alcoholic?
Yes, and probably a drug user and things like that, but what a genius. Between his invention of the detective short story, really, the three stories about the Inspector Auguste Dupin, which became ultimately the basis for Sherlock Holmes, and his brilliant horror stories. I mean, he's just an amazing writer.
Oh, my God, what a mind.
An amazing writer.
We'll do a little rendition of him every once in a while, and I still
well,
get
he's clearly a god to H.P. Lovecraft.
Telltale
Lovecraft
Heart.
Just worship Poe's writing.
The classic, Telltale Heart, huh?
Yes. and The Black Cat, one of my favorites, and of course The Pit and The Pendulum. I remember reading that in high school and just being
How would you categorize Stephen King today with them?
Well, King very much was a fan of Lovecraft's work, and a Sherlockian. Stephen King loves Sherlock Holmes and has written at least one of his own Sherlock Holmes stories called Dr. Watson's Case. So clearly knew these great masters and was inspired by them and took off from them in his own work, I think building a tremendous body of his own brilliant stories. I love the Dark Tower series. I think it's really compelling writing. And it's frankly probably his least successful, but he owes a great deal to these earlier writers, as do writers like Dean Koontz, Clive Barker, so on. They all would tell you that Peter Straub especially, deeply influenced by Lovecraft and Poe before him.
Les, we're going to come back. Final hour to go. We're going to take phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM.